WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Patrick Smith, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Solidarity, agency, creativity. Those are just some of the words that describe Chicago's disability arts scene. So for Disability Pride Month, we wanted to convene a panel of artists working across mediums to be in dialogue with one another and think beyond the stereotypical narratives that surround disabled people. I sat down with Reva Lehrer, an artist, writer, and curator who's best known for painting people whose physical embodiment, sexuality, or gender identity have long been stigmatized. Robbie Lee Williams, a Black and Latine disabled dancer working to create more inclusive dance, and Andy Slater, a blind media artist, access worker, and teaching artist. And Reva started us off with a tradition in the disability community, which is to go around the table and describe what each person looks like. Here's Reva.
I am a short white woman in her 60s who dresses not like a woman in her 60s. My hair is white with big red streaks in it. I'm wearing a black shell top and skirt and giant orthopedic boots and glasses.
Excellent. I'm a middle-aged white guy with reddish brown hair and I guess salt and cayenne pepper beard, full beard, wearing red glasses today. I don't know. Almost 50, and I dress like I'm almost 50. I dress like a dad.
I like this, Reva. You set us up so we all say whether or not we dress our age.
Yeah. Good on you, Andy.
I have on a watch that currently isn't working, but it's my fidget toy. So there we go.
Excellent.
Robbie?
All right. I'm a brown skinned man with black hair and a blue shirt, black pants, and a purple wheelchair. I feel like I crashed into like a convention for Prince in memory of him.
I love that. Nice. I am an overweight, white guy, with a red beard, and I'm wearing a button down shirt. 'Cause that's what you have to wear if you go into the office. Not to suggest that I would have more flair on if I was outside, I would just not have a button down shirt on probably. Andy, let's start with you. How would you say, what makes the disability arts community in Chicago unique?
When I think about it, we're just such a great group of fun and weird people that really find the importance in showing up for each other. And I don't know, kind of having this air of like access, intimacy, and, you know, collaboration, and just being kind of more Chicago than anywhere else. And I think that we produce a whole bunch of great work. You know, people, different kinds of disabilities, different accommodations, different styles of art. And I think that we're in a situation where we could all exhibit together and it would all make sense.
Excellent. And Reva, my understanding is you were one of the key players who really helped build the scene that Andy's describing. I mean, tell us about the experience of building that scene and how you've seen it evolve.
I guess I'm disability grandma.
I didn't say that.
So I am from the time before the ADA, and when I first started making work about impairment or trying to, there was no context and no encouragement and extreme discouragement from professional world, which still exists. But in the mid-90s, I met a group of disabled artists, writers, performers, including Susan Nussbaum, Mike Irvin, Teki Limnicki, Bill Shannon, people who were really foundational, and they invited me into a group called the Disabled Artists Coalition. And I found a home because they were snarky as hell. And they were really radical. And I'd never seen anything like it. So one of the things about the community here is that it's been around quite a while. And it's kind of ebbed and, flown. I lost my word there.
Ebbed and flowed? Yeah, you flowed.
It didn't sound right. For decades. But also UIC has been really instrumental. The Disability Studies Department has been increasingly a player in creating performance space, gallery space, studio space. And that's amazing to have sort of a consistent commitment from a real force in the city to be there for us. So I'm thrilled that at this point, I don't know everybody in the community. It used to be.
Yeah.
I could fit them all in my living room. And that's not true anymore.
Well, and that's a good thing. I mean, Robbie, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think of the trio here, you're the most recent member of this community that we're talking about. What was it like joining the scene? How did it seem to you when you first became a part of this art scene?
For me, I acquired my disability about 6 years ago. Coming into this community, this group of people was incredibly welcoming. It was open. Everybody was like, all right, well, you're one of us, so let's kind of give you the education you need. Let's get you started. Let's kind of give you ideas to challenge your own, like, internalized ableism that's going to be there, because we all have it, and how to navigate that. And it's been a wonderful experience.
Tell me more about that. I mean, you mentioned you acquired your disability just a few years ago, and you had internalized ableism. Can you get more specific about that? I mean, what you had to unlearn and how you use dance to work through that?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So before my injury, I was an Argentine tango dancer, swing dance as well socially. And when I acquired my spinal cord injury, I was like, well, I guess this is probably the end for my dance career. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I lucked out. My physical therapist was a professional dancer, and went out, put feelers out, and found things that were around Chicago. And we have the Inclusive Dance Festival. Mm-hmm. We have a bunch of other dancers. And they were like, all right, well, we're going to bring you into this. And so that first step of not thinking dance was possible was that little keystone that needed to be pulled out to cause the whole arch of ableism to start falling.
That's incredible. And Reva, I know when you talked with our producer Max before, you talked about, you can talk about the big themes, but you want to make sure you actually talk about the work. I'm going to ask you a question that's kind of a little bit of both. Collaboration is a main theme that you've all talked about. Reva, you don't paint subjects. You call the people you paint your collaborators.
Yes.
Can you explain that to me?
When I was part of that original coalition back in the 90s, I was already in art school, and there was this day that we were in a meeting, and I had almost a hallucination where everybody at the table suddenly looked like some version of a Renaissance painting. Like, I was seeing Leonardo and Raphael and even Van Eyck and in all of these people. But one of the themes that came up all the time when we talked was toxic staring, how being looked at was often for us, and still for me very often, a disturbing experience. The way people react to us, the intentional and unintentional insults. I thought, if I'm going to ask people if I can paint them, which is what I wanted to do, I was going to have to find a way to not replicate that horrible experience of, I'm going to stare at you and make you feel judged and awful about yourself. Hey, have a nice day. So the way to do that to me was to give people a lot of autonomy over how their image was going to go. The point was, how do you want to see yourself in the world? And how can I make that happen in a way that you can't do for yourself? So that evolved into this structure of ethics about other things in disability have to do with mutual care, in interdependence rather than independence. So there's a lot that goes into my work about caretaking. And then the final step was, how can I make myself as vulnerable as my subject? So I'm sitting there, Patrick, staring at you, but you're looking at me. So how can I make it as risky for me as the person I'm working with?
Robbie, I wonder, in dance, I mean, do you think it's important for people to have a say in how they're represented, and how does that factor into, how do you approach that in dance?
Yeah, absolutely. So in a lot of what you'll see on kind of social media, you'll see kind of this mixed bag of disabled people creating dance for themselves with disabled people and with non-disabled people. Sometimes you'll see what we call translation or transposition, where you watch another dancer move and you try to make movements that evoke that emotion instead of just something that is almost like infantilizing to us. Say, for example, the opening number to a chorus line starts with your arms going up right, then left, then back down, right, then left. In like an idea of that could be just being still in my chair and just doing the arms. Or we could work to make it more dynamic, play around with it, and I could add movement to it. I could push myself forward to start it, throw myself back to finish it, playing around with these movements.
Excellent. Andy, I want to ask a little bit about your work. You created a series called Invisible Ink, where you created audio descriptions and alt text of images that you kept blank. Let's take a listen to a snippet of one of those descriptions.
In the foreground and at the bottom right corner of this painting is a splintering wooden stake. Under each splintered piece is a dark shade of gray and brown wood.
So, Andy, tell us more about this series and the purpose of it.
So, as a blind person, and I, you know, with a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree, having to go through art school and being very skeptical on whether visual art and painting and all that stuff is important to a blind person, and, you know, not being able to have these sort of like shared museum experiences where I'll go with a guide and someone will be able to describe the work to me in a, you know, in a way that's meaningful or even gives me the opportunity to decide whether it's good art or bad art or whatever. You know, it's kind of like, take me there, prove to me that the painting exists, talk to me about it and that sort of thing. And it's often like a dictated experience to a blind person, right? You don't have your own way of really telling, you know, if somebody's telling the truth or, you know, if they're you know, exaggerating or if they're or right or anything like that. So with the invisible ink thing, just being the descriptions of the images and the paintings don't really exist, gives me the opportunity to do whatever I want and create the stuff that I do see in my mind. Mm-hmm. And that years ago, maybe I would have been able to do it. But, you know, painting is a lot of work, right, Riva? and so I would much rather, you know, write descriptions and then, you know, use that in a gallery sense to critique, you know, the institutional critique of like museums and access and how these descriptions, this access, this is for art. So there shouldn't be standards and stop trying to, you know, make things as if it's you're describing like a diagram or, you know, some kind of scientific thing or something like that. Make it weird. And then if people can go to the gallery or listen or read the text and picture this in their mind, or at least appreciate the weird way that I write it, then, you know, that's my goal. But at the same time, just kind of being a mischievous little jerk and saying, like, no, this is a painting. This is here. You know, this is my experience or some other blind people's experience where I'm standing in a museum and there's stuff in front of me. What am I looking at? And then so, you know, really digging into the conceptual mess that is my mind and then just kind of bringing this out. And yeah, and I think I came up with it because I needed work examples for this grant that I was, or this award I was applying for. And it's like, yeah, this will be easy. And it wasn't, but
yeah, I was going to say,
you
know, it doesn't seem easy.
Yeah, and then so, you know, I have the series and then, yeah, not only does it exist as text, but also as that spoken word.
WBEZ's nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Andy, I want to stay with you. You know, all three of the panel here, you all work in different mediums. You also have different access needs, which is true for the broader disability arts community that we're talking about. What does solidarity across different disabilities look like to you?
Oh, man. So, I don't know. It's sometimes really hard to find, even in, like, disabled spaces, right? Mm. There's still this sort of, like, mystery behind what do blind people need, right? Like, we need image description or alternative text, audio description or video description, something like that for any kind of, like, you know, media, visual media. And that's very time intensive, and you can't really, like, AI that all that stuff yet. So there's just this sort of, like, disconnect of what, you know, some people think that we need. And so being able to, I don't know, provide that in the work that I create, as well as, you know, also, like, doing descriptions of sounds for people that may not hear it or may not want to hear it, and just, you know, considering any kind of accommodation that you think that you can pull off and incorporate into your work without having to let the curator or the museum or whatever put it together. That way you control the narrative, right? And so that within my art is how I kind of keep this solidarity going. But then at the same time, it's like what I found here in Chicago, which is kind of different from other cities and countries that I've worked in or visited or whatever, is that if a space, like a performance space or a gallery or something, isn't accessible to all of us, if, like, we can't get in, or someone's going to be left out because of, like, negligence, or somebody not, you know, really paying attention to any kind of accommodations, that we often just don't show there. We're like, you know, forget it. Like, come back when you're ready for us. You know, pretty quick to walk away from something, or to take it over and just say, move out of the way. We'll do this. That sort of thing.
So Robbie, oh, go ahead, Reva.
No, please.
No. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, a couple things. Pardon me. I have a problem with coughing, so forgive me, audience. So I curated for years, and one of the things that I tell organizations, museums, things like that, even now, is that often accommodations will collide, and don't burn out. That we're still trying to figure this out, and if they're trying to provide accessibility, that there are going to be conflicts, and just slowly unsnarl the knot. But the other thing that's been on my mind is what representation is. And I find that in a lot of spaces, they take what I think of as, you know what, let's let Robbie talk.
Yeah, I want to come back to you actually and ask you in a second about the Monster Studio. But Robbie, let me ask you, we're talking about good art and the power of good art, but let me ask a little bit about bad art. One big stereotypical narrative is inspiration porn. Robbie, help define that for us. How do you resist that in your dance practice?
Yeah. So inspiration porn is those videos, pictures that you see that are made to invoke, these feel-good emotions, and that's the only point of them. Like if you see a kid with crutches who is somehow, like, using stairs, and somebody could be like, oh, this, it's so powerful. He's overcoming this kind of barrier for himself. And that's really easy to do with wheelchair dance, where people will look at us and be like, oh, look, they're so beautiful dancing in the wheelchair. They're overcoming their disability. And that's the idea that we try to attack a lot in community, is our disabilities aren't things to overcome. The mechanism of disability, like in my case, it's acquired, that can be tragic, but the disability itself is just a part of my body. It's a part of who I am, and that's how we try to navigate in all of our creation.
What new work are you really excited about?
I'm sculpting. I'm doing stuff in the foundry. I'm kind of walking away from sound and everything and realizing that there is a lot of merit in making things with my hands, and I brought some props.
Oh, wow.
This is an ancient conductor, and this is an ancient microphone. I'm holding them up. That's the description I'm going to give you. And so that's what I've been burnt out with, trying to make technology and things like that accessible all the time, which, you know, it's, you know, corporations need to listen to the artists and, you know, and so I'm just going back to basics.
Excellent. Riva, I want to close with you, and I'm sorry that we have to keep it kind of quick, but you have a gallery opening coming up with a, quote, monster studio. Tell us about that.
So I have a show opening on September 6th that will run till October 12th at Zola Lieberman Gallery in River North. And what I'm doing is the show is divided into two pieces. One is completed work, including some well-known disabled Chicago artists here that we did mutual portraits of each other. But the other half is a live portrait studio. And what I've been doing is thinking a lot about identity and how identity these days is constructed as what the world does to you, sort of accumulation of damage. And what I'm doing is turning that around. And I'm asking people, selected collaborators, to talk to me about their effect on the world, themselves as agents, and what is monstrous about being an agent, what is scary, intentional effect, unintentional effect, what's hard about being in the world.
Excellent. Can't wait for that. We've been talking with disabled artists Riva Lehrer, Andy Slater, and Robbie Lee Williams about Chicago's disability arts and culture scene. Thank you all so much for being here.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Max Lubers. It was edited by Meha Ahmad. If you loved this conversation, make sure you tune back in tomorrow and subscribe to the podcast so you never miss another one. You can also check out our full archive at wbez.org/reset. I'm Patrick Smith, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.